Welcome to another episode of True Crime Jamaica from the History of the Caribbean. On today's episode, we are looking at the case of how the Garrisons were born, politics, guns, and the ghetto. If you are not following us, we would be honored if you would consider doing so. It costs you nothing to hit that button so that you will be notified every time we release a new episode. Now, let's get into it. Kingston, Jamaica. The years just after independence. The houses are built from whatever the city threw away. Zinc roofs, board walls, floors of packed earth, families of 7 and 2 rooms, children in clean, pressed uniforms, share the same narrow lanes as men carrying machetes at their sides. This is the inner city of Kingston. Not one community, but dozens of interlocking communities, pressed up against each other along the western and central corridors of the capital. Where the poorest of the poor landed after the countryside could no longer hold them. Most people living there did not experience their neighborhood as a slum. They experienced it as the only world they had. They did not yet know that decisions were already being made about their world, who would live in it, who would be removed from it, and what the people brought in to replace them would be expected to give in return. That exchange, housing for loyalty, safety for votes, was about to become the defining architecture of Jamaican political life for the next 60 years. This is the story of how the Garrisons were born. Jamaica gained its independence from Britain on August 6, 1962. Two political parties divided the ambitions of the new nation between them. The Jamaica Labour Party, the JLP, built around Alexander Bustamante and the trade union movement he had led since the 1930s. The People's National Party, the PMP, built around Norman Manley, Bustamante's cousin and political rival. Both parties came out of the same labor movement that had shaken the island in 1938. Both parties claimed to speak for the working poor of Kingston's inner city. Both were about to use the working poor as soldiers. The roots of what was coming stretched back even before independence. The small arms surveys, institutional research on Jamaican gang violence documents that the division of inner city neighborhoods according to political allegiance began as early as the late 1940s, when the founders of the two parties, Norman Manley and Alexander Bustamante, were already drawing rival supporters into different sections of Kingston and violently forcing the other side out. This was the antecedent, by 2 decades, of the Garrison system that would define Kingston's political geography. By the early 1960s, violence had become institutionalized in modern Jamaican politics. The Columbia University doctoral dissertation on the evolution of political violence in Jamaica from 1940 to 1980 documents this institutionalization precisely, a symbiotic relationship between Jamaican labor organizations and political violence in which party loyalists dependent on political patronage, were encouraged by the parties to defend local constituencies and participate in political conflict. The general election process had become, in the words of that research, ominous and violent, with limited political patronage dispersed among loyal party supporters as the primary mechanism of political control. The rude boys, the young, unemployed men who moved through Kingston's inner city lanes, did not invent this system. They were recruited into it. Jamaica's economy after independence was still largely controlled by foreign interests. Jobs were scarce, wages were low, and the state had no serious safety net for the families crowded into the western corridors of the capital. When a party man came to a corner and offered food, a small payment, or the promise of housing in exchange for turning up at a rally or driving the other party's people out of a neighborhood, it was not a complicated choice for a young man with no other options. That transaction was the foundation of everything that came after. The U.S. Department of Justice Institutional Report on Jamaican Pazas, produced by the Immigration and Naturalization Service Resource Information Center in 1999, and drawing directly on the National Committee on Political Tribalism Report, commissioned by the Jamaican government itself, states plainly, the Jamaican Pazas began in the late 1960s and 1970s as urban gangs recruited and armed by politicians to organize local constituencies, distribute political favors, enforce party loyalty, and turn out votes. Gangs were created by members of both the JLP and the PNP. the use of armed gangs and the promotion of violence as strategic initiatives to secure or retain political power became known in Jamaica as political tribalism. Both sides built this. Both sides fed it. Neither side told the truth about it in public. The gangs, led by local men who would come to be called Dons, established urban political strongholds known as garrison communities, territories completely controlled by one political party, states within a state in which those who sought to oppose the dominant party would definitely be in danger of suffering serious damage to their possessions or person. That language comes directly from the National Committee on Political Tribalism report of 1997. A committee appointed by the Prime Minister himself, with representatives from all three major political parties. They knew what they had built. They wrote it down in an official government report. The physical shape of the garrison system was set in the 1960s with the creation of Tivoli Gardens. The small arms survey documents how a combination of political favoritism and state housing allocation, partisan political violence, and gang rivalries harnessed to political parties produced the first formal garrison community in the Western Corridor of Kingston. Residents brought into the new housing were expected to vote as a bloc, maintain political loyalty, and provide physical enforcement of the party's territorial claim when called upon. Those who had previously lived on that land and who held different political allegiances were displaced. They did not build a community, they built a vote. The people who moved into the new garrison housing were not criminals. Most were working families, grateful for a roof that did not leak. But the arrangement they entered was not purely residential. It came with an expectation. You owed your vote. You owed your physical presence when the party called. You owed your loyalty to the enforcer who maintained the neighborhood's political identity. And if the other party's people entered your area, the community's protection network was expected to ensure they did not stay. In the years that followed, this model was not challenged. It was replicated. The PNP, watching the JLP entrench itself in West Kingston, built its own garrisons. The JLP, watching the PNP expand through St. Andrew, responded with further entrenchment. By the late 1970s, both PNP and JLP garrison communities had been established throughout Kingston, in the adjacent St. Andrew Parish to the north, and in St. Catherine Parish to the west, where the principal city is Spanish Town. The Amnesty International Institutional Report documents that long-term political violence required the empowerment of strong and violent armed leaders who would enforce the political agenda in each community and help create garrison communities through violence and intimidation. This was the design. Enforcement through armed men. Loyalty through fear. You did not wander into the wrong garrison by mistake. Not twice. The streets became maps of allegiance. One side of the road was JLP. The next block was PNP. Those two blocks might as well have been two different countries. A man seen attending the rival party's rally could come home to find his belongings outside, or not come home at all. Families were divided. The Amnesty International report records testimonies from residents describing political violence not as something that happened at election time and then stopped, but as a condition of daily life, a background threat that became acute whenever an election approached and then settled back into a persistent lower-level menace between campaigns. Then, in the 1970s, the guns arrived in volume. The National Committee on Political Tribalism report, cited in both the DOJ institutional record and the Amnesty International report, states directly, "The political clashes of the late 1960s, particularly in the election period of 1967, ushered in the era of firearm offenses against the person, and party politics remained a major cause of violence. What had begun as enforcement through fists, sticks, and machetes was becoming enforcement through firearms. Both major parties were supplying weapons through intermediaries to the enforcers who held their garrison communities." The same institutional record that confirms this was produced not by journalists or activists, but by a government-appointed committee that included representatives of the parties themselves. They armed the communities they claimed to represent. The 1976 general election tore Kingston apart. By the run-up to the 1980 elections, the DOJ institutional report records that running battles between PNP and JLP possess resulted in an estimated 800 political killings and nearly 20,000 people burned out of their homes. The Amnesty International report confirms the 1980 election as the peak of garrison-generated political violence, stating that political violence reached a high point in the 1980 elections when around 800 people were killed in clashes between rival groups. 800 dead, 20,000 displaced, in a single electoral campaign. By the time the elections were over, the garrison system had produced something that looked less like democracy and more like a low-grade civil war conducted in Kingston's streets by proxy armies that two political parties had built, armed and sustained, over two decades. And then the cocaine arrived. In the early 1980s, Jamaica became a transshipment point for cocaine and marijuana moving from South America into the United States. The gangs, which had begun calling themselves Possess, drawn from the imagery of American Western films playing in Kingston cinemas, found themselves positioned to take a share of that trade. The Small Arms Survey documents the critical transition. With this new source of income, Possess and their dons could rely less on the patronage of politicians and began to operate more independently. A don, who controlled a corner of the drug trade, no longer needed to wait for a party representative to deliver supplies. He could buy his own weapons. He could pay his own enforcers. He could expand, and he could refuse political instructions he found inconvenient. The politicians had created these structures to serve party interests. By the early 1980s, the dons understood that they had interests of their own. The DOJ institutional report notes that while specifically political violence did not return to the heights of the 1980s after that point, garrison control of communities through force and intimidation actually expanded. In 1989, three electoral constituencies in Kingston, St. Andrew, and St. Catherine were identified as unambiguously garrisoned. By 1997, that number had risen to eight, nearly double, with four additional constituencies showing one-party domination above 50%. The garrison was not declining, it was spreading. The Amnesty International report makes the connection explicit. Garrison constituencies amounted to approximately 20% of all political constituencies in Jamaica. Yet in 2005, these constituencies, along with urban areas of St. James, accounted for 79% of all murders in Jamaica. 20% of constituencies, 79% of the murders. The Small Arms Survey documents that by 2009, government intelligence identified 268 active gangs operating throughout the island, a five-fold increase over estimates from just 11 years earlier in 1998. Over the preceding decade, murders committed in Jamaica had almost doubled. More than 13,000 people had been murdered since 2000. The people who paid the heaviest price through all of this were the residents of the garrison communities themselves. Most of them were not gang members. The Amnesty International report is precise on this point. Core gang members represented no more than 5% of the population of these communities. The other 95% were mothers working two jobs, schoolchildren who had to time their route home around the geography of neighborhood violence, men who had lived in their house for 30 years and did not want to be at war with anyone. But the garrison was the only world available to them. The Amnesty International report records what the state's absence meant in practice. Because the government was not socially intervening in these communities, gang leaders who dealt with petty crime in their area also dealt with school problems for all children, provided food for elderly residents, distributed legal and illegal jobs, and took the role of the state at a basic level. The price for that service provision was total, unconditional loyalty. You were not free to be neutral. You were not free to move between communities without consequence. You were not free to choose a different political party if your garrison community belonged to the other one. The space between those two positions simply did not exist. For the children who were born into these communities, who inherited this world without ever choosing it, that absence of neutral ground was perhaps the heaviest inheritance of all. The Small Arms Survey documents that the roots of contemporary Jamaican gang violence trace back to the organized political violence of the 1940s. With the political facilitation of crime described as remaining an enduring, though less overt, force. Even into the 21st century, the politicians who built these structures knew what they were doing.
The National Committee on Political Tribalism, a committee appointed by the Prime Minister of Jamaica with representatives from all major political parties, recorded in its own report that many politicians benefited from the unrest and displacement that are features of communities with high levels of unemployment, a proliferation of unskilled and virtually unemployable youth, and pervasive poverty.
The same committee noted that political protection insulated garrison-based gangs from the reach of the security forces, meaning the politicians actively shielded the enforcers from police accountability to preserve their operational usefulness. They were not passive beneficiaries of a system that grew out of control. They built it knowingly, maintained it strategically, and protected it legally. The Amnesty International report states the conclusion plainly, drawing on the Jamaican government's own documents. The Jamaican leadership recognized its own responsibility in this crisis through the creation and perpetuation of a political system that relies on gang leaders to gain electoral support, corruption, and tolerance of organized crime. This is the crime at the center of this story. Not one shooting, not one election, not one The crime is a system designed and executed by both major political parties across six decades, funded by political patronage and then by cocaine money, sustained by the poverty it promised to solve, protected by the same state structures that should have dismantled it, and paid for in blood by the ordinary people who had no power to refuse it and no authority to leave it. The garrisons outlived every politician who created them, and the children who grew up inside them, who were born into the transaction their parents had been forced to accept, who inherited the political identity of their neighborhood before they were old enough to vote, never received an apology, never received an accounting, never received anything except the next election, the next cycle of violence, and the same garrisons waiting. They did not build a community. They built a vote, and the people who lived inside it paid for that transaction with their lives, their safety, and their futures for more than 60 years and counting. That was the story of how the garrisons were born. Politics, guns, and the ghetto. If this episode moved you, if it taught you something, if it kept you up, share it. Follow us if you have not already, and stay close, because on the next episode of True Crime Jamaica, we are going somewhere you are not ready for.